Hello and welcome back to Enterprise Linux Security. We're at episode 117. As always, I'm here with my good friend Zhao, and we're going to talk about some security shenanigans, which is what we already do, or always do. How you doing?
All good. As always, it's a pleasure being here with you. Yeah, we have quite a few stories to cover today. We'll be talking about hardware problems, apparently. We'll be talking about Microsoft a lot. We'll be talking about Facebook and how it keeps doing the wrong things all the time. And then just to wrap it up, some AI and some CVEs, because everybody loves a good CVE story.
Yeah, lots and lots of stuff. So before we get started, I just wanted to mention that as of today, I'm at 980,000 subscribers. So I am dangerously close to a million. So if you haven't already subscribed, please do that. And if you want to help keep the lights on, consider going to the official shop at merch.learnlinux.tv. We have t-shirts, mugs, mouse pads, desk pads, hats, all kinds of Linux-related gear over there. So check it out. Again, merch.learnlinux.tv. And we appreciate your support. So the first story, this is interesting because this is something that impacted me. Before we hit the record button, actually several hours ago, Jouse already sent these stories over, and I started reading the one about Proxmox that I'll be covering right now with the host setting in the CPU. But I was able to reproduce this personally, instantly. So I can absolutely confirm that this is a real problem. Obviously, everything we talk about is real, but this kind of hit home because it impacted me personally. So the issue, there's been a recent Windows update. And the reason why we bring this up is because, you know, this is in regard to Proxmox, which is built on Linux, but lots of people that run Proxmox will have a Windows VM, especially people that are switching over to Linux and they need, you know, a Windows machine to, you know, run this or that. So on my end, I actually encountered this. And what it is if you have the CPU set to host, which you should, because in that case, you know, host CPU features can be exposed to the VM. So a lot of people, I don't want to call it a best practice, but a lot of people are going to have this configured, and rightfully so. But if this is the case, a recent Windows update is causing the machine to blue screen when you have this set. And interestingly enough, I set up a DVR recently. I decided to run it on a Raspberry Pi because, you know, I have a bunch lying around. So I set it up and I get it working and it's great. And it's called Channels DVR. So 2 months later, maybe 3 months later, on their website, they mentioned that they're going to end support for Linux and Raspberry Pi. So I'm like, great, I just set this up. So I'm already invested at this point, already have my configuration. I really don't want to start over. So I figure, you know, I have an extra Windows 11 license, so I'll just throw it in a Proxmox VM and I'll just run the DVR software there. So I get it set up several months ago, and it again, it's fine, everything's fine. On my end, I didn't encounter any issues at first because I had the CPU setting in the Proxmox VM set to something else. I don't remember what the something else was. It was just a generic setting. So when I read this story about the host setting triggering a blue screen of death, I immediately figured, you know what? I have some time. Let's see if I could trigger this. So I go in the VM and I set the CPU type to host, and then I reboot the VM and blue screen of death. And it started another chain of events, which I'll mention shortly, but I could personally confirm that, at least as of today, it's not fixed. I checked for new updates and, you know, nothing. So as of right now, it's absolutely something you might run into on Proxmox.
And not just on Proxmox. Proxmox actually runs on top of KVM. The issue here seems to be with how KVM passes this to Windows, or better, how Windows actually interprets that string regarding the CPU. Something changed on the Windows side. The update in question is KB5060842. This is one that showed up like in the past 10 days or so. And if you have updates pending and you have a virtualized environment running on Proxmox or running on KVM, QEMU KVM, or something else that's running on top of that, you might want to think twice before you deploy that and check the host setting like Jay just mentioned. So here's the thing. Lots of people are moving off of VMware because of their crazy licensing right now. Proxmox is an alternative. There's people running their own QEMU, KVM setups, and they're running fine. But things like these really shoot you in the foot. The thing with using host, this is actually fairly standard, even in an enterprise environment, when you have lots of servers that have exactly the same hardware config. The only time when you don't want to run host and you want to specify a setting there is when you have different types of CPUs or different types of architectures, or you're running mixed AMD and Intel environments, and you want to be able to live migrate machines from one to the other. If you do that on different CPU host settings, you'll probably run into problems. So you will define a baseline, a base value for host, and you'll set that across your environment. The thing here is that, as you were saying, you had something else set up there. When you set up something that refers to a CPU type that's lower or inferior than the one that you actually have on your hardware, KVM will mask the features that you might have so that the guest operating system will never try to use those features. When you have AVX 512, for example, and you say that you have a lower CPU that does not support that, any workload that you run inside the VM will not use AVX 512, even if your CPU actually supports it. And that's a problem because you're paying for the hardware and you're not fully utilizing it. This was, like you said, this hits home pretty quickly. I wasn't even aware of this story when I had issues with VMs because I applied updates to some server, Windows Server 2025. Oh, by the way, this impacts Windows Server, this impacts Windows 11, this impacts Windows 10. The update is available for all of the systems. And I Googled the problem because the blue screen of tests happens immediately upon boot, and the message that it comes back up with is unsupported CPU. And when you see that on a VM that had been running fine for months or even years at the time, then something changed and it wasn't the actual VM. So yeah, this is a nice surprise for people that are up to date on their updates. Not intended pun there. But if you're keeping up with the updates and you're bitten by something like this, it makes you think twice about being the first one to deploy them.
Yeah, and this caused a parallel, unrelated issue for me that I want to just mention just in case someone runs into this. So parallel to this, and again, unrelated to this story, at some point an update happened within Windows where the skip button has been removed from it's called the out-of-box experience, although that's normally when you're setting up a machine for the first time. This actually happens after login. It's like a more like a reminder screen. Microsoft is like, you know, we really want you to sign into your Microsoft account. And, you know, most people like myself, we just click skip and bypass it and go to the desktop. And on my end, this would come up every now and then. Again, it's like there's, you know, when you say skip, it doesn't disable it, but it just pauses it and it comes back. So anyway, when I rebooted my Windows VM to test the the issue that Joe and I just mentioned, an update must have happened that didn't trigger because I hadn't rebooted the VM. So when I rebooted the VM to test the main story or the first story, it immediately came up with a screen that says you need to sign into a Microsoft account. The skip button is gone. Now, Windows people are already saying in their heads, you know, you could just hit, is it Shift F10? I can never remember.
Shift F10.
Yep. So you do Shift F10, and then you can enter a command prompt, and there's a way to bypass that. Now, according to Security Now, I haven't tested this before. Security Now is another podcast, one that I enjoy listening to. They were talking about that command going away. Now, there's already that same day they mentioned it, a workaround to that. So it's like this war between Microsoft and trying to get their users' data. Now, personally, my Windows VM, I just had a Windows 11 Pro license. It's not Enterprise or Windows Server or anything. I don't really know whether this change impacts Windows Server. I doubt it because Zhao and I were talking earlier and you know, like he mentioned, it's not really a good idea to force this and then disrupt an image deployment of Windows desktops in the enterprise. So yeah, I don't know about the enterprise version, but on Windows 11 Pro, if you're running that in a VM, at least you might run into this. And what I did to solve it, and this worked for me, in Proxmox, I went into the settings for the VM after I shut the VM down, and I checked the box that says disconnect, which basically emulates an unplugged Ethernet cable so that there's no network connectivity within the VM. And then when I started it, that screen did not appear. And then there's some settings. I'm going to actually go to our signal chat because I already forgot what they were. So under additional settings and system notifications, there's three checkboxes. So if you're going to update Windows in Proxmox, and I know I'm going to stop talking about Windows, but there's three checkboxes to not show the Windows welcome experience. That's what they're calling it. So if you're running Windows in Proxmox, just make sure you do that. The war continues. And one of the reasons why I mentioned this is because we're going to talk about another privacy-related story later on in the podcast, which is kind of weird that the two things are happening at the same time. But I think that's enough Windows. I think the only thing I can mention is that I don't know when, or even if, but presumably when Microsoft is going to fix this. So as of recording time, I'm completely up to date on the VM, and it happens. So.
If you're wondering if your systems are going to be impacted, for sure we can guarantee that it impacts AMD CPUs, Ryzen, Threadrippers, Epics. All of those are impacted by this if you're running one of those systems. And again, 3-year-old, 4-year-old, 5-year-old AMD systems, they were selling like hotcakes. They were the best thing out there for the enterprise. So lots of companies will have these systems if they were playing their game correctly. They will all be impacted by this. And we might all love Linux, we love it dearly, and we prefer it over any other operating system. But the thing is, sometimes the requirements from the real world force us to use Windows or other operating systems that we don't like, and we are probably running Windows on some of the enterprise VMs that we have. So if you have those, if you have those on your update plan, if you have maintenance windows coming up, pay special attention that you test the VMs and make sure that they come up properly. And if they don't, look for the host string on your hypervisor. Another fun thing about this problem. So Microsoft actually pulled this update a few days after it went live. And you would imagine that it was because they wanted to fix the virtualization problem that they caused. It turns out it wasn't. So the thing that made Microsoft pull this update was because it was affecting anti-cheat software, so that gamers would be having issues in which the games would simply close upon launching, and that was a major problem. Fixing this because of the virtualization issue they introduced? No, that's not enough to pull the update. That problem still remains. So regardless of the update having been away for a couple of days, it's back and it still has that issue. So keep an eye out on that if you're updating Windows systems that you might have. This will probably bite you.
Yeah, so if you're running GPU pass-through on a Proxmox VM to play your games, they fixed your games by pulling this, or you know, reverting that change, but then broke it again by making your VM not boot.
They're nice like that.
Yeah.
Okay, because we like bashing companies that don't really care about your privacy, let's talk about Facebook. Everybody loves Facebook, right?
No.
So let's start with something slightly different than Facebook. Let's start with Yandex. Yandex, for the uninitiated, is Facebook in the Russian-speaking world. Yandex has been running a sneaky way of tracking users for over 5 years now. Meta, or Facebook, not wanting to be second place, they look at what Yandex was doing and said, hold my beer, so they also started doing the same underhanded thing. So Imagine the following scenario. You have on your phone, on your Android phone, you have Facebook's application, you open the application, you do whatever you do on that tab, and then you close it, you go to your web browser, you turn on incognito mode because you want to see something confidential or you don't want to be tracked, and guess what? Facebook still manages to track you while you're doing that. Even though you're in incognito mode, you're not accepting any cookies, just because you're running the Facebook app on your system, Facebook still manages to get that information from Chrome. This is really underhanded. And the trick here is that the code behind the meta tracking pixel and the Yandex equivalent will send the cookie identifier that you're using inside of the browser, even if you're in incognito mode, to localhost. It will try to communicate with a port that is bound to localhost on your Android phone. And guess what's listening on that port? The Facebook app. So the Facebook app will receive that identifier that it gets from the tracking pixel, and it will be able to marry that new identifier that you supposedly got because you were incognito and marry it to your account. So even though you're definitely trying not to be tracked, Facebook still manages to get all your data.
Which is illegal. I mean, there has to be.
Which is illegal in every single jurisdiction. I mean, not going too further into this, it violates GDPR, it violates the Digital Markets Act, it violates a host of other laws and legislations regarding privacy. And they absolutely know that this is illegal and that they shouldn't be doing it. Because the same day that the researchers that found this published the discovery, they stopped doing it. The very same day that the information was made public. If that's not the smoking gun itself, I mean, what is?
Yeah, I like their wording that Meta came back with, which was basically like, oh, we're sorry for the miscommunication that Google had with their policies or something like that. I couldn't find the quote in time, but basically they're just underhandedly, you know, trying to say, oh yeah, we didn't do anything wrong. It's a misunderstanding on Google's end. But Google was very clear that this is a violation, and that's what they came back with.
Yeah, if essentially Google tells companies that if you have a website, if you have some tracking functionality, and the user is in incognito mode, you shouldn't try to collate that information with any other identifier that you might have. They explicitly have this. Again, this is even more insidious than that. If you saw any of this behavior in any other application, you would flag your antivirus would flag it as malware. Yandex's app, before they bind to localhost and they start listening to a port, they let a few days go by. So they won't do it when you launch it the day that you install it. They won't do it the day after. They'll start doing it after 10 days post the install. They really know that they shouldn't be doing it, so they try to avoid being detected as best as they can. So, yeah.
Yeah. It's absolutely devious. And, you know, when our parents told us when we were kids not to accept cookies from strangers, they had no idea how right they were. And now it's like the cookies are being shoved down our throat. They're just being the app is just taking information. And since it's on localhost, you know, it's local, so it's not being checked. Well, it is now, actually, but
yeah, but it avoids all of the triggers. It won't be flagged by the firewall. It won't be flagged by any early warning systems that you might have or any alerting because it's just communicating with the localhost. The transparency problem here is just insidious. Facebook knows that they're doing something wrong. And if you look at the fines, just from the easy pickings, the laws that absolutely are being broken here by doing this, the fines that they're probably going to get from this are in the billions with the B. And they know that, they weight that, and they still value running this type of thing more than the fines that they know that they're going to pay. So, yeah, it's how important that information is. And for the enterprise world, when you sometimes see company policies that say that on work phones you shouldn't have social media applications deployed, it's because they're crapware like this. They will do their utmost to work against the user. They will try to exfiltrate as much information about you as they can. Right now, what was found was just exfiltrating the identifier from your browser session into your Facebook application or your Yandex application. But they could essentially share any type of information because the channel, the communication to localhost directly, is not being checked anywhere. It won't flag anything. So whatever they wanted to send through this communication channel could be sent. And then you already are running Facebook and you know that you're running Facebook and you already allowed Facebook to reach the internet. So whatever comes from the browser hits the Facebook app and then gets sent wherever they want it to be. So, yeah, fun.
So this fits the definition of malware. Facebook officially fits the definition of malware. It's opening up something on your local device that's listening for connections and reporting back to a command and control center without you knowing it. Like, that is absolutely malware.
Like I said, any other application doing this type of behavior, it would inevitably be flagged as malware.
Wow.
Go figure why they still want to do it this way.
Yeah, wow. Fun times.
Another thing that isn't malware, but you might want to start thinking about it, is Model Context Protocol. Let's shift a bit to AI right now. AI chatbots, when you go and talk to ChatGPT on their website, that's just the first level of artificial intelligence. It's useful, but it's limited in what it can do. At most, it can browse the internet, and not even all of the chatbots can do that. The next level is software with embedded AI. For example, Cursor for development, where while you're developing, while you're writing code, it talks back to the internet, it talks back to the models, and it gives you the feedback in real time. But that is still limited in what it can do. Model Context Protocol, or MCP, is a solution that Anthropic came up with to standardize the way that those agents can talk to tooling, meaning that you might have an agent that tells whatever application you're running that has AI, how to access the file system, or how to open a connection to the database, or how to open a web browser, or how to look at the logs in your system. And from that moment on, the AI agent that you're running inside of that application has that functionality. Just yesterday or the day before, I got an email about NetData having an MCP server that lets you look at the logs directly. So when you're talking to their AI agent, you'll get actual information directly taken from the system where you're running NetData. There's lots of functionality around this. This, by the way, this is something that was invented and has been put out there in the past 2 months. It's how old this is. There's already a marketplace where you can go and download many different types of MCP servers for all the different agents out there. So this exploded pretty quickly. All the major AI companies, OpenAI, Anthropic, all of those, Google, they all embraced MCP immediately. So yeah, just as AI is evolving like day to day, this type of technologies that are around AI, they are also evolving day to day. But this actually poses a problem for security. This will be run from the workstation that your users are using, and they will run in their context. So think about that. If you have a workstation that's running on a privileged network segment or has access to a few servers that otherwise wouldn't be reachable, and you let the user deploy an MCP server that can now look at the network traffic, for example, you don't exactly know where that network traffic is going to end up. Like we were talking about with Yandex and Facebook, you don't know where that is going to end up, and you're opening the gates there, and you're letting outside eyes looking at internal stuff that otherwise wouldn't be accessible. If you're covering the security side of your infrastructure, if you're interested in the security side of it, you should at the very least take a look at the marketplace for MCP and see the kind of stuff that's available there. If you're comfortable that your users can run that without causing any problems, great. Personally, I wouldn't let my users deploy half of those, if I was being honest.
Yeah, on the onset, I mean, it kind of seems very useful. And to put it into context before I get to the bad, as Jao was saying, you know, AI agents that are installed, you know, Claude AI, ChatGPT, whatever you're using, you know, you could ask, how old is a celebrity? And it'll give you an answer. You could ask it, write me an Ansible playbook that installs Tmux or something. And then you could copy and paste that text and use it on your server, which, you know, can help you write code faster. But what it doesn't do is interact with the local computer. But with this, you could say something like, you know, ChatGPT, write a letter to my boss, but then say, put that text in a LibreOffice document and save it as a, you know, ODT file. And then the chat agent is able to do that. It's able to get to the host system and it's able to interact with the software. Now let's talk about why that's bad. So when you're at work, for example, let's just say somebody is in the development team, and they say, hey, AI, give me a list of all the current products that we're developing for fourth quarter. And then it gives you a list. And if that's going through, you know, the network, because it's pulling the list from a database or it's pulling the list from a file on your own computer, now if you're being eavesdropped on, a threat actor could have a list of all the things that your company is developing that, you know, is still under an NDA, or financial information, or even worse. I mean, if API keys ever cross the wire in clear text, then threat actors have API keys or passwords, especially if you speak the password, which I hope nobody does. And then, you know, that's being exfiltrated. So like Jia was saying, it's a matter of where is that information going? And then recently we had Windows recall come and go and then come again, which, you know, for the same reason, it's keeping track of everything you're doing on your computer. And even with that, it's a privacy risk because, you know, if there's someone eavesdropping or if the data gets exfiltrated, then the threat actors or a third party now has that data. So while this is very useful, it could allow us to control our computer even, you know, hey, AI, open LibreOffice. I keep using that as an example. But when you get down into the nitty gritty, the information going over the network, who's listening, that's a huge concern, and it creates another vector for stealing information.
And unfortunately, that's not the only risk factor here. AI can make mistakes. We all know that it can supposedly hallucinate. Hallucinate is just an euphemism for lying or making a mistake. Suppose you have your AI agent now being able to traverse the file server that you have at your company. And you tell it, okay, go and delete all the files that are over 3 months old, for example, from my directory. And now it asks the MCP server. The MCP server tells it, okay, this is the file system, and you want to delete the files, and I can do that, and everything is great. Now it makes a mistake, and it confuses the 3 months old, and it just does the ones that are 3 days old. Easy mistake to make. And now you just gave it access to the file system, and it will try to do that, and it will happily delete all the files that are over 3 days old when you wanted 3 months. That's just the type of mistakes that it can make. When you incorporate this into more complex scenarios or more complex workflows, it's pretty easy to get the details wrong, and the MCP servers give them enough power and enough ability to be really dangerous.
Yeah, exactly. We don't trust AI any more than we trust, you know, running as root. You know, essentially, you know, we use sudo to kind of have that extra layer of protection, maybe a bad example, but with this being, you know, at the system level, having access to network shares that you have mounted to your workstation, you know, you could literally see prototypes or, you know, being stolen or deleted, and spec files, blueprints being deleted. I mean, that I've seen those things get deleted in the enterprise, and it is one of the worst things that could happen.
So someone is asking about shedding some light on how this can be used in DevOps or system administration at scale. This is a 2-month-old technology. I don't want to sound like a Luddite here, but I'm not particularly happy of having a 2-month-old technology running free on my infra. I would definitely keep that confined as much as possible for as long as possible until I'm absolutely sure that there's no way you can make a mistake that will ruin everything. Right now, it's pretty handy, it's pretty good to giving you you an individual decent enough answers and decent enough responses that you can use for your work. Automating everything and relying on MCP servers to give it more power, when you're not absolutely positively sure that it won't make an obvious mistake and something silly, and there's nobody looking at that before it does it, I wouldn't feel confident releasing this on the infrastructure. At the current state, where everything seems to be in flux and changing day to day, I absolutely am not confident in doing that. Maybe another couple of months down the line, maybe after decent testing, maybe after a specific scenario for what I know is going to happen, and in a heavily restricted environment. If an MCP server requires access to the entire network, or to the database server, or whatever it is, I wouldn't want it running against prod. I would absolutely require that it runs against a confined copy or replica of whatever it's supposed to be running against, and I want to be convinced that at least for a few months it runs perfectly fine with absolutely no failures. If there's a failure, it doesn't get to touch production at all.
Yeah, another thing that you might want to consider thinking about is legal issues. This can create a legal issue. Like, just imagine, you know, as a system administrator, you renew a license for your workstations for some piece of software via the vendor, you get the license, and then you tell AI to make sure that license is installed in all the workstations, but it doesn't do it right, and then you're out of compliance with licensing, and then the software vendor wants to sue you. Or to Zhao's point about, you know, you ask for files to be deleted between a certain date range. If it gets it wrong, then if you have local legal requirements on data retention, you're now out of compliance because AI misconstrued a command, used the wrong time zone if it's not using the same time zone as you. There's all kinds of things that it can that could go wrong if you trust AI too soon. And now, speaking for me personally, I've been using AI a lot lately with some development stuff. But even with that, as useful as it is, and to be fair, it's more useful now than it's been in a long time, but it usually takes me three times to have code be perfectly right. Like, it misunderstands, you know, what I'm trying to do, or maybe the code that it gives me doesn't solve the problem when I deploy the code and test it and it still doesn't fix it. Then I got to go back and say, you know, it doesn't fix it. You know, there's all these, I mean, I guess my point is, if I have to try that many times, on average, two or three times to get correct information, then, you know, why would we trust that to do something important like interact with our data? And I just can't think of a good reason to trust it unless, like Zhao said, that it has more time. I mean, in the enterprise, there's a lot of people that won't trust something that hasn't seen 10 years of deployment, especially in file systems. So keep that in mind. Now a few months later, it's here. And that's just not in our comfort zone. When you're a seasoned sysadmin, it's not in your comfort zone to trust something that young.
I mean, the enterprise completely hates change. We really don't like... Everybody loves to run the latest and greatest stuff on their home labs. If I have to run it on mission critical stuff, I absolutely want it to be stable. I don't want to be any unfound bugs there on whatever I'm running on production, because that will bring down systems that I need them to be kept running. That causes problems. Two-muscle technology, I absolutely wouldn't touch it with a very long pole. Let it run there in the wild. If you want to run it, make sure that you test it first, and it's perfectly fine. If you want to run it for your environment, I'm talking about my personal experience there and the amount of issues that we have to troubleshoot whenever we deploy new stuff that hasn't been properly vetted. And I wouldn't want to give too much power to a tool that absolutely can create havoc on the infrastructure. If you look at the MCP market, you'll understand why I'm saying this. There are MCP servers, and again, don't let the name fool you. An MCP server is just a very simple application that talks to the AI agent in a standardized protocol, and the AI agent will give the MCP server a request, and the MCP server will then execute it. There are MCP servers to do a whole host of different things. That's why I'm saying take a look at the MCP marketplace. Even if you trust your users, you know that your users wouldn't make silly mistakes. But the AI agents, they will often do silly mistakes. And then you'll correct them and then, oh yeah, absolutely, that's right. And they are very flattering and they will tell you that you're the best and greatest and everything you want to hear in between. But they make absolutely simple mistakes. They're very good at solving some problems. They're really good at writing code that sometimes works. But they make really, really silly mistakes sometimes. I'm not confident with that. I'm not saying that anybody else has to be like that. You probably trust AI and that's good for you. I have some serious questions about it. I will take some time to let that run in my environment. And I absolutely won't do a blanket accept for all the MCP servers out there. It has to go and be vetted by all the teams that will touch it. And it has to be vetted by the people responsible for the systems that it will be touching. So, yeah, there's a lot of testing involved.
There really is. In my case, I asked AI to give me a playbook to install the Cosmic desktop environment, but I wanted to omit a package and not the entire group. So people that know DNF group install, and you can install an entire group of packages in one shot. So I asked it to do this, and it gave me syntactically correct code where it had, you know, the name of the package was at and then the group name. And then underneath that, exclude equals and the package name. And I go to try it, it doesn't work. And then I tell AI, well, hey, it didn't work. And then it said, literally said, oh, you're right. There's an issue in Ansible where exclude doesn't apply to group packages. And for additional context, you know, I think it was around 13 years ago that Wayland was introduced. Okay, we're only just now moving off of Xorg and migrating fully to Wayland after all this time, and we're going to trust this after 2 months. So, yeah.
And again, I perfectly understand that the timescale around the AI enhancements, it's absolutely crazy. It's one day to the next, and there's a new model that does something amazing or much better than what was there before. That's fine, as long as you're comfortable with that. And from experience, the enterprise world is not like that. Has never been. Trusting new Linux distributions. I mean, finance doesn't trust a Linux distribution until it reaches the extended support phase. That's 5 years after launch. So, yeah, keep that in mind.
Yep.
Going to something more cheerful. Let's talk about CVEs because everybody loves them. So, Qualys Threat Research Unit. They came out, and this is just like from June 18th, so 2 days ago at the time of recording. And they discovered two linked local privilege exhalation flaws. We all love those. The first one is a problem in the pluggable authentication model in PAM. It affects only OpenSUSE Lib 15 and SUSE Linux Enterprise 15. So you're not running SUSE, you're very happy because it doesn't affect you. Hold that thought. So the first vulnerability, it's CVE-2025-6018. Using this vulnerability, an unprivileged local attacker, for example via SSH, can elevate to the allow active user and evolve bulk kit actions normally reserved for physically present user. I'm reading from their description. The allow active user is exactly that. Is someone that's touching the actual physical console for the system. They have privileges to do things like ejecting hard disks and attaching new devices to the system, and there's privileges in the system which are only assigned to that class of users. This flaw lets anybody impersonate that and get that type of privilege. Again, you're not running SUSE, so you're perfectly fine with that. The second CVE that came out in the same bulletin is CVE-2025-6019, so one more than the previous. It affects libblockdev. If you're not familiar with libblockdev, you're probably familiar with the tool that actually uses this, which is called udisks. It's on every single Linux distribution out there at this point, and it's nasty because it allows an allow active user, remember those, we just talked about them, to gain full root privileges. So if you have privileges to be allow active, you can get full root privileges from this vulnerability. So on its own, the last vulnerability, 6019, requires that allow active context. So if you're on SUSE 15, and you have the ability to get the allow active privileges, congrats, you now can get root directly from there. If you're not on SUSE, there are other ways to get allow active. There are other vulnerabilities in the past that let you get allow active privileges. So you're not out of the woods. This one is just the springboard to move from allow active to actually root on the system. So yeah, congrats. You have updates in your future.
I think it's very important to just highlight the fact that this is literally how threat actors gain access to a system. You know, maybe at first they can get SSH, so they get it into the system via SSH, but maybe they end up with a low priority user that could do nothing, that they can't install packages, they can't create a file, they can't read information. So they have a completely useless login or connection to the system. What they're going to do from there is try to find a vulnerability. Why can't I say that word today? And basically try to elevate to the next level and elevate to the next level. The ultimate goal is root. That's what I think every threat actor that is trying to break into a system, that's what they want. Because once you get to root, as many people know in the audience, you own the system at that point. So even a situation where a threat actor gets like maybe a printer user, they break into the, which shouldn't be externally available anyway, but they get into the system via a low priority user that does not have system access. And then they use vulnerability chaining to try to get to the next level and the next level. And that's exactly what this is right here. That's exactly what this is. They're going from, you know, one vulnerability to another, and then they get root, and then it's game over.
Simple as that. So digging a bit deeper on the UDISCS vulnerability, which affects all the Linux distros out there. So what an attacker that has the local active privileges already wants to do is that they will create a malicious XFS image and they will ask UDISC to mount it. That malicious XFS image will have an SUID root binary in there, and when UDISC mounts that, it will give that user access to that SUID binary, and when the attacker runs it, it will give it root privileges. It's as simple as that. And all the Linux distros out there run UDISC in a way that's vulnerable to this. So you will effectively have to deploy updates to protect against this. Funny thing, I was actually alerted for this from a blog post on the Alma Linux website, because Alma Linux released, by request from users, a fix for this before the upstream. The upstream for Alma Linux is Red Hat. Red Hat either hasn't released yet or will release very shortly the fix for it. But if you're running Alma Linux, you already have ways to deploy the patches for your system.
Yep, being ahead of the game. One of my favorite distros, definitely.
Again, this doesn't impact you just the home type of distros. It affects your Ubuntu's, your Fedora's, your whatever you're running at home, but also the enterprise stuff. The RHEL's, the CentOS's, the Alma Linux, the Rockies, all of those are affected by this. You might want to take a look at the updates that you have. If you don't have them yet, you will very shortly. Keep these numbers in mind, CVE-2025-6018, that only affects SUSE, and -6019, that affects all the Linux distros.
Yep, yep, keep your updates. As we keep telling everyone, just keep patching. Just like if Dory was a Linux admin, just keep patching. Sorry, I couldn't resist.
And that's our show for today. Thank you everybody who joined. As always, it was a pleasure, and until the next one.
See you next time.